Our sermon this morning is entitled Winter, Freedom, and Religion, Three Meditations. And so I'll begin with winter. Now, feng shui, now that's a concept that we've all or a lot of us have heard about recently, perhaps. I hear that people will try to create the right feng shui or spiritual mood. Perhaps that's a good interpretation of that. And they'll do that in the rooms of their homes by rearranging, adding, eliminating various objects in their room or painting the room different colors, that sort of thing. And it seems a good thing to do. But for me, anyway, a finer thing would be to simply to walk out the door of one's house and into the sun and the clouds and the winds and the air, where the colors of the sky and the light and the arrangements of the trees and the grass and the drifts of snow will overwhelm you, I think, with their evocation of emotion. The seasons are nature's feng shui, and they can be had by nearly anyone for merely the cost of throwing a coat upon your back. Now, in the winter season, it seems we often don't want to go outside. We often don't want to throw our coats on our backs. It's a bleak time. It can feel that way. The days arrive short. They're gray often. The landscape is lifeless. It's icy. That's very common. And the drifts of snow upon the cornfields, and we have those here back home, and you have them here too, they will resemble pictures I've seen of the planet Mars. I have to admit that. So it's an otherworldly time, winter can be. I've felt this alienness myself in winter, as if the cold wind had stripped away this film of green upon the world. And now, the landscape laid bare to browns and whites and ice and these stick figures of trees, like I'm seeing reality in a way for the first time. All the green has been stripped away, and I can see what lies underneath. The vast night sky, the night skies in winter always seem bigger to me. The vast night sky teeming with the lights of worlds so far away, and we keep finding more of those. The stars seem to descend close to the land in the winter time. And the cold of a winter's night seems not so different from what the cold of space might be. It's like we're getting a little closer to that outer space. I leave the warmth of my hearth stove to split dry red oak. That's one of my favorite things to do in the winter. And in the dead still air, I catch the cherry and the smoke meat aroma of the wood. It has a tremendously distinctive smell. And this bizarre scent, it's a very strange aroma, reminds me that I am glimpsing the innards of things, that I'm perceiving now in the wintertime what otherwise is always hidden from me. When else do we ever experience the inside of a tree? I'll walk our field pathways. I'm a farmer. Or I'll try to walk the field pathways anyway. Sometimes the snow gets a little deep for that. And I'll stand exhausted, hardly able to have gotten myself to the spot where I am, a spot that was once so well traveled and filled with conversation. It was filled with tractor rumble, with bird calls. But in the winter, it's lonely, it's still, it's gray. But it's here that I can feel or sense and hear the swish of the falling snow. And looking up, looking sideways, see the millions and billions of snowflakes falling gently to the ground. That's worth doing. And they're everywhere around me, everywhere, and I'll stick out my tongue and try to catch them. And I am hushed by what I have a sense that I was never meant to see. I have the sense that I'm not supposed to be here. I'm seeing things that aren't for ordinary people. But I have seen it. I am seeing it. It's like I'm seeing the stars and the galaxies themselves being born. Each snowflake is a star or a galaxy. I'm seeing the machinery of creation, as it were, right there in my snowy, hushed, old tomato field. So we see things in the wintertime, if we can go outside. We see other worldly kinds of things. The mood of winter is this bringing to presentation of things not seen in the bustle of summery life. It's too busy in the summer, right? The machinery of creation, for example, that is a winter vision that would be a disturbance to me in my summer work. I'm too busy in the summer. We're all too busy in the summer to pay attention to the machinery of creation. We're too enamored of all of the activity of life that happens in the spring and the summer. Now, the poet Robert Frost, I think, feels winter the same way that I'm talking about. Death, right? That's what that poem is often about, and I think that's true. Death reveals itself to him in the snowy woods, right? Death in the dim presence of some vague owner of the woods, right? In whose woods death works its own machinery. The snowy woods, too, seem strange to us, right? They're a strange place to be if you ever stand in the woods in the snow, right? That's why Frost's poor horse acts the way it does, right? He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. I mean, why would you ever stand in the woods like that? You're supposed to be going someplace. But yet Frost stops anyways because he's so enchanted by what he is seeing. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. That's what Frost writes. For I believe that Frost sees in his kept, or he sees that eventually his kept promises and his traveled miles will someday end, and that they will end in these woods filled up in snow. And so Frost has this somewhat disturbing vision of death, briefly, because it's almost not appropriate because he's still alive. But for a moment, he sees the machinery of the cycle of birth and death. And that disturbing vision is always the gift of those who adventure away from the warm village lights, right, and step into the winter. And such a vision can bring solace because although our lives are snowflakes, they are finally dropping into a silent wood. Right, we are like the stars in the galaxies too. We are created, and we fall, and then someday we stop. And it's a silent wood that we drop into, but the woods are lovely, dark, and deep. So the second meditation is freedom. Now, a walk in the winter woods is not a gay affair. The Frost poem isn't gay either. It's not a very happy poem. It's a peaceful poem, but happiness and peace are different things. I can feel a bit frightening to be in the winter woods. There is almost an overbearing silence in the winter woods, and this silence can evoke a feeling of emptiness. We humans, we're a social species. We don't embrace emptiness very, very readily, and when emptiness does confront us, we are apt to fill it with something. That's the way we are. We, of course, are free to fill this emptiness with whatever we want, but I find that this act of filling, okay, in myself anyway, is almost always an autobiographical process. It's almost compulsively autobiographical. Now, I grew up in a Navy family, and so I moved every few years, and because of that, I never had the chance to form really close friendships when I was young, friendships that I know some people have that last for years and years and years, and I never had a chance to do that. That's something I have to accept in my life. And so during my winter walks into the gray woods, okay, where the silence can lay heavy sometimes in the mist that sometimes is out there, I imagine companionship. I imagine intimate companionship, a companionship which I cannot escape, right? No matter how much moving around I'm going to do, that companionship will always be with me. And yet, if it's going to be a companionship that's always going to be with me, it's going to be a strange kind of companionship and a kind of inhuman kind of companionship because there would have to be a certain omniscience to it. And I admit, I often wonder if God is the creation of lonely people. children or lonely people, and it's the refuse of those who are unnaturally isolated. I don't know the answer to that, but I wonder that about myself anyway. And to walk in the winter woods is to place a mirror before your own soul, right? That's what solitude does. It makes us look at ourselves. And the chill, the sparse quiet of winter becomes that place of self-knowledge. So again, we see things that ordinarily we're too busy to see. And so in Wisconsin, the snowy grove of the bur oak becomes our bow tree, right? Now Robert Frost, of course, he's been to this bow tree too, right? He's been to this place, discovering his mortality in the sweep of snowflake, but also discovering that for now, he may leave the snowy woods. He may choose the village. He makes a choice. He may choose the village and ignore the mystic persuasion of the snowy woods. They evoke him. He wants to stay there. They seduce him, but he leaves anyways. And he leaves because he says, I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And so the loves of our lives pull us too, right? Our commitments. They pull us away from winter walks. We walk the winter paths, but one eye always keeps in view the warm firelight, which leaves our windows and settles gently upon the new snow, right? It's like a doorway back home, sort of waiting patiently, right, with calm vigilance, calling us away from the swells of snowflakes and kind of back to our porch. That's why it's so wonderful in the winter that the light leaves the window. It's almost like a pathway back to the house, a pathway back to our commitments, our loves. We're not supposed to stay out there yet. So winter agitates us then. It agitates us with the choice between this mystic snowy woods with its vision of the way creation works. And then there's the warm village wood stove, the wood stove of our own home. Now Sartre once wrote that humanity is condemned to be free. We have to choose whether we want to or not. But here in Wisconsin, we have winter to tell us this. Winter will tell us that, I think. Now, in the springtime, of course, it's obvious what to do, right? It's time to grow and grow and plant and work and do. There isn't any time to choose. It's just time to move. And things are slow in winter. Nothing moves but our own slow shuffle in the deep snow. So time makes us look at the act of choosing. That's what winter does. It makes us look at our freedom. There's nothing like standing alone in some snowy field, deciding whether to keep walking or to return home, right? To lay bare the mechanics of choice. So when I'm doing that, I stand there and I grow cold. That's always interesting, though. As cold as you get, you don't want to leave. And Frost stands there too, right? To the agitation of his horse. Now, how does Frost choose to move on to the village? Why do I stand there, snowflakes melting on my nose, so cold that even the dog leaves me for the house? Sometimes I've stood there so long the dog leaves. Now, choice or freedom is not some creatio ex nihilo. We are condemned to be free, that's true, condemned to choose, but we don't choose out of nothing. Okay, we choose for reasons. And to stand in the wintry presence of choice is to stand with whatever lightly taps our shivering shoulders and says, it is more beautiful to make this choice rather than another. Now Frost, in his poem, stands before both the woods, which are lovely, dark, and deep, and his promises to keep. How does he leave the woods? How does he perceive the greater beauty of his promises rather than just staying and seeing the beauty of creation at work? But beauty is not some intellectual exercise. The haunting colors of birch bark upon snow against the steel blue of a January evening. We do not decide that the birch grove upon evening light is beautiful. I don't think we make a choice about that. No, the very birch grove upon evening itself, the very event of it, it possesses us. It is beautiful, and it takes us. We are made to feel this way. The winter landscape itself creates what we are in that moment. Robert Frost's poem again. Where is his own initiative in that poem? There isn't any. He actually doesn't appear to have any of his own initiative, although he does make a choice. There just seems to be him sitting there, taken by the winter moment, telling us what it is. And Frost's poem, for me, expresses the winter message that before freedom, before choice, we are chosen, we are created, and we are the product of a landscape, the product of a world. And that brings me to the last meditation, which is religion. Now, it's discomforting, these winter discoveries. The self-knowledge brought by our winter wanderings, by my winter wanderings, reveals how created we are, how much we are the product of wood and wind and fire and food and other people. Winter is the season for the solitary walk, because the stillness, the silence, the silver birch bark upon the gray-tinted snow disclose that there is no real solitude. We are created by things every moment. To feel alone is not to feel like you are the only thing. To feel alone is to feel the formative presence of what lies beneath the curtain of ordinary life. And that's what winter does. It reveals that to us. Now, Whitehead, my favorite philosopher, once wrote that religion is what a man does with his solitude. And I say, religion is what a person does on a winter walk. What a person does with those vague felt presences that create us and that erupt in front of us in the wintertime. And no other season can make that eruption happen. Now, our story for all ages takes us into the past, and it shows another way of being religious, right? That old, stern Christianity. I suppose some people might attain moral or spiritual insight by sitting so rigidly all day. I suppose they might, I don't know, reading the same book over and over again and maintaining the appearance of meditative peace, okay, while, at least for their children, right, the twin shadows of force and authority haunt the house. And that's an unfortunate common combination, religion and authority. And woe be to those children, right, who would profane authority in the name of play, right? That's something that I hear echoed in that story. And yet, I warrant from our meditations that religion is the profaning of authority. That's what our UU and my free thought tradition teaches us, that there is an alternative to authority, and religion is the alternative to authority. There can be self-knowledge only when we open ourselves up to it, only when we explore. We do have to leave the house and choose to walk in those snowy woods. We have to go out there and find it for ourselves. We are responsible for our own meaning, for discovering our own meaning. One thing I like so much about our story for all ages is the courage that those three children showed. It was a very courageous thing for them to do, to defy so forceful an authority just to play for a moment in the winter snow. And I warrant that we all must be like that. There's a message there. We should all be that way if we want to have our own religion rather than have it stuffed down our throats by some authority figure. We have to walk out of the house. We have to walk out of our office. We have to walk out of our church, frankly, and walk among the free congregation of wood and wind and snow and sky. Now, these brave children, and that's how I see them, they were brave, they were courageous. They teach me how to finish my haunted winter walks. They play. That's what they do. Now, why can't I do that? Why don't I play as much as I do? Now, I accept that I will not rush out to play right away as they do. I'm not a kid. I'm a grown-up. And it is the burden of adulthood to perceive consciously the machinery of creation, to see it there, and to stand there in the snowy field with the million snowflakes and see that creation at work and say yes to it or no to it. We have that responsibility as adults. Children aren't there yet. They don't have that yet. And I want to accept it. I want to accept that machinery. If the vague presences which haunt my winter walks create me, what else am I to do but accept it? It's a part of me anyways. So I think I should also play, though. If I play and go sledding, then I will trudge hard in the deep snow, and feel that deep snow so much that I will be the deep snow, right? Because I'll fall into it off of the sled. And I will race down that hill so fast that the cold wind will shock me. And the cold wind will take me up, all of me, right? You'll feel that cold wind so much that it will be who you are for a moment. If I play in the snow and the wind and the cold and the wood, then I will be filled to overflowing with the snow and the wind and the cold and the wood. And I will, for those playful moments, fully know what it is that creates me. I think in the end, religion is always about play. Play, I think, is the most religious thing that we can ever do because we open ourselves up to the whole world. And that's how we discover and explore our own meaning in life. Our religion is what, in my opinion, is what we fill ourselves up with when we play. The sun, the snow, the rain, the waves, children, God, lovers, soil, whatever it may be. It could be many, many different things. And so I'm very glad for winter. When I think about it and feel it, let myself feel it, I'm very glad for winter, for the slowness, for the grayness, for the coldness of it, which slows me down and cools me down and gives me a chance to see my own religion. And I thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.